you very much for including me in this nice workshop. And after I got the invitation that what I could present, and I really would like to show some work that I've been doing with a couple of young people in Austin, both of them in the audience, Maria Valdani and Richard Sharp. Richard is a postdoc at ISES, currently at San Carlos Mellon University, and a very fine numerical analyst. And I'm going to defect all technical questions regarding computations to Richard as time comes. And I make him responsible for the flaws, if any. On the numerical scheme, not on the other. Well, I think it's very nice what we got. Okay, so we are going to look at this. I think for this audience, you might be tired today of looking at these equations once more. It's pretty much in the spirit of the first lecture of the Anton Arnold lecture this morning. So essentially, what we have been doing is discussing with Richard and Maria is how can you do an implementation, a numerical implementation for the Wigner-Fokker-Planck equation. And this is something that I have been interested through the years. I did some preliminary work a few years ago with Kim Chi. We never put it on writing, but I put a lot of energy at the time for that. We were not doing the Fokker-Planck term, and so we retook it about perhaps a couple of years ago. And sorry, the Asian community going
not fighting. It's not my fault.
Not your fault. No, it's not your fault. Neither mine. Okay. And but it put me a lot of my brain into at the time into trying to do this process. So it was very fortunate that we got together, stand about 2 years ago, into looking into these problems. And in fact, Maria, you did some preliminary presentation in Banff about a year and a half ago, or almost 2 years ago. And so by now we have much more. And so indeed we have the Wigner Fokker-Planck equation, and what we are going to be looking at is at particular semi-classical transport in the correct spaces, as precisely were described this morning by Anton. Do we have something to? Okay. No, that's okay. I can use that. So the. Very good. Okay. So the way we are going to be looking at this at we call it an H space. It could be a space with some decay. Perhaps sometimes numerically you may wonder what is the right decay. Also analytically, the correct decay is to weight it with respect to an admissible stationary state, which is kind of the challenges, in fact, for this type of problem, is to find those stationary states and for what kind of potentials you would do it. About the operator, just let me say it, I like to call it environmental interactions with the system, and it satisfies the properties as you see them this morning, and I will remind them for you in a minute. So when you look at this operator, it's a sort of full diffusion operator, although it degenerates because some of these parameters depends on the quantum scale constant, the Planck constant. So the pseudo-differential operator that appears in this term, again, comes, you might think, it was addressed several times today. It comes from the taking the Wigner transform on the wave function from the Hamiltonian part of the quantum system. And in that case, it is defined exactly as this sort of, as you will see later on, is related to taking a convolution with the imaginary part of the Fourier transform, of the anti-Fourier transform associated to this difference potential with this particular shift. And so we have to, what we are going to be discussing today is this problem endowed with initial boundary conditions and some sort of, from the numerical aspect, boundary conditions on which we are going to confine ourselves to such confinement potentials that we can assume them to be zero at the edges. And so we very carefully are going to discuss how do I decide and how to select the domain. Okay? Because I don't want to do, for instance, we don't put periodic. So any of these things, for instance, would have to be strongly revised if you would do strong transport that would actually push probabilities towards the object. Okay? So none of what you are going to see today gets the important part of the probability distributions close to the boundary.
Which is, of course, the whole problem with confinement.
Precisely, and that is what we need. That's what I'm going to tell you how we try to do that. Indeed. Okay? So, in fact, the test that we do has are for strongly confined potentials. Okay? I mean, with that, all right, at least I think if I do not know how to deal with strong confinement, probably I would not be able to do it any other way. And, okay. So, about the interaction operator is the classical quantum focal plane operator satisfying, I will go very fast here, the Lindblad condition, and you may not want to see this again, and the Lindblad condition is uniform in the Planck constant and is well established that as for the operator part, as h goes to Planck constant goes to zero, then you recover the classical focal Planck transport dynamics. And if you have the correct scaling, as Peter was describing a while ago, you describe the classical transport. And the second observation, which is also well established in this community, is that if I take any harmonic potential with a constant shift at most, then the pseudo-differential operator is a classical transport operator, and that is an exact calculation, and we are going to use that as part of a tool for the fact that the things we are going to be computing are going to be perturbations of harmonic potentials. Okay, and that's what I mean in strong confinement, I mean exactly that. Okay? So so in that sense, we take then the dimensionless formulation that we've been working with is in this form. We notice that some of the theory has a two here and some of the slides we have use the theory, we have used it with a factor of two here, but in the setting, in the calculations that we are doing for confinement potentials are with a constant one, and so our stationary states are consistent with this particular formulation. And so I recall for you that the pseudo-differential operator has a beautiful representation. As I said, it's minus the imaginary parts of the anti-Fourier transform of the difference of shifted potentials combined with the solution. And in fact, the real part is going to be zero because this always, the shift is such that it's an odd function in the parameter eta, which is where the shift is in here. And so the equation it's a linear equation in W, and as I will show you, the numerical evaluation of the convolution formal is practical for our purposes because it allows us to deal with perturbations potentials that may have some good structure, for instance, if you do trigonometric expansions or spectral expansions. Okay. So the computational approach that we design, that we use is designed for the special case on which the potential consists actually as a harmonic plus a perturbation of sinusoidal functions. And in that we use the, as I said, the inverse Fourier transform, which yields the point mass of the convolution form. I think I repeated part of the previous slide, so I apologize for that. So let me start here recalling some of the results because are going to be important, because one of the things we wanted to do is to benchmark the solver, and in order to benchmark it, I really need to follow up what are the established decays or rates, because it's something we can actually calculate very explicitly, and so it gives a little bit of meaning to what the calculation is doing and allow us to, for instance, to calibrate properly the computational domain as well as the correct basis function. And so I would just recall the, as Anton mentioned today, the work of Sparver, Carrillo, Dubois, and Markovich for the particular case of the harmonic potential. In that case, you really have classical dynamics. It's absolutely nothing quantum, because you have a Fokker-Planck equation. I mean, you have even if it is quantum Fokker-Planck, it is a field diffusion equation with a Fraktal transfer, so it's a really parabolic system. The only interesting aspect there, as you see, is that they discuss the existence of a stationary state, which we actually, as I said, the numbers you see here, this quadratic form corresponds to really the right-hand side that we have, in which case they said the weighted L2 norm with a stationary state, which is what was discussed this morning, Anton, actually decays exponentially to proportional to decays exponentially to zero, and so it's proportional to the distance from the initial state to the stationary state as well in the same space. And that is, again, this has been discussed today, and you see how we use it to calibrate our solver, or at least to benchmark the solver. So how do we determine the computational domain? And this is what we do here, and it's a little bit of observing and just adjusting it, but at least I'm trying to come up with a reasonable, consistent way to justify why the domain is the way we take it. Okay, and we need to, actually, it's a lot of, as I said, trial and error, but at least if you do know that your potential is confined enough to have essentially a stationary state that is integrable in such a way that you can, for any arbitrary epsilon, you pick up some domain omega epsilon, as we call it, for which the mass would be uniformly in epsilon, if you do have an estimate of that kind. So if your perturbation is going to be small enough with respect, I mean, for large time, with respect to, or we have a sort of, if your perturbation of the harmonic potential would allow you for the existence of a stationary state for which there is a decay, it might not necessarily be exponential, it's enough that actually you get here a bounded function of time that goes to zero as t goes to infinity. Okay, then it's all I need to be able to say that whatever we are going to be working on our solution, okay, in the L2 weighted norms in the domain are going to be controlled by then the decay rates in the whole space plus the decay rate in the smaller domain, which here is an error of epsilon, and here I know that as t goes to infinity, I will get better and better and better. And that allows us to say that whatever error, because I'm going to discuss error estimates, so the difference between the solution in the cutoff domain minus the difference in the whole domain is going to be of order of epsilon for a large t, where that t is going to be a t star. So t for any larger for any t larger than t star, where t star I pick it up to be the quantity for which this is very. Of order of epsilon uniformly in time, then I can secure that I have error estimates which are going to be bad up to an order of epsilon. Okay? I mean, it's not a big deal, but it's just an observation that allows us to say that my scheme would not deteriorate. I would just have error of the numerical scheme, but not errors because I'm losing any mass. Okay? And I observe that, in particular, just the answer that the decay rate, if you wish, g of t is bounded and going to zero, It's enough to get this statement true. And of course, this can actually, this can be very small if you start, for instance, close to the initial step.
Can you quickly state why the second term has no W dependence in it?
It's a, pardon?
In the top, in the in these top.
Oh, okay, because I have added and subtracted mu and I use the BK rate estimate.
Why does the second term have no W?
Because I added here, right, I added and subtracted mu, the stationary state. I'm using here the knowledge that I have a stationary state, that I have mu.
It's a sharp estimate.
Yeah.
So W is zero, it's not true.
Yeah. Right, I mean, it's just a way to say it. I mean, it's, this is not, I'm not discovering powder, gunpowder. Right? It's just a way for us to control. And I know that if I do it in here, and in fact, that's the way we choose the domain, because we start the calculations, right? We don't know what is going to be a good, large enough domain. But I see as we start to see stabilization, we adjust it. And so a posteriori can tell you what it is, okay?
So there's a relationship.
But you have to, what I'm trying to say, you have to be very careful, okay? You cannot choose the domain after you have done several calculations.
Especially if g goes to zero slowly.
For instance, if it goes slowly, then you have to wait much longer. All right? Okay. So for the calculations that we do, we can actually write error estimates because that's one of the advantages using discontinuous Galerkin schemes. We're essentially it's done, for what we do is this schemes for parabolic equations, but then we deal with the pseudo-differential operator, and the estimates follow very nicely, in fact, from the work of Arnold Sparber and later Arnold Damon Mancini, which they actually give us a very nice estimate on the L2 norms, or in particular for finite domains. I mean, what I'm dealing now is with finite volume domains, and so in particular, even if they are weighted with a finite volume domain, I can always get a good uniform estimate in time for global estimate for the L2 norms of the pseudo-differential operators in terms of the solution. And they actually did it for the potential. I should say that these theorems, and Anton, please correct me if I'm wrong, because I believe that I'm not sure it's a washer, right? global in time estimates for a very general perturbation potential from a harmonic one, which is in W1 infinite. And you will see what happens actually, because I will show you calculations on perturbations that are so big from the harmonic potential that we, for instance, cannot conclude. They're still confined because it's an infinite perturbation, so at x goes to infinite, you still have confinement, but we cannot conclude even uniqueness of a stationary state. I'm very puzzled, and we have been very careful in checking the code on the correct sentence, on the things that should be. So, okay. Few numerical simulations available for the Wigner-Fokker problem. One of them, and perhaps the earliest one, is Arnold and Rienhofer, also here in the audience, which you did sort of a spectral collocation type of simulation. Then there was some Shu and Fee, and some finite different approach from Cossett in 04. Very recently, well, not so recently, before, there's papers of Garcia Palacios and Sueco, on which these come from the physics community, and they have actually been doing a Hermite expansion, but Hermite basis function expansion, so collocation of Hermite function type of method, but in that case, there is something that I found that, okay, the Hermite functions are only in phase space, but there is something somehow puzzling is that they just do it for harmonic potentials without the interaction operator, and they put on still to compute the quantum Fokker planar. And what we do is actually, even a correction, as I say, we will use some basis functions which use sort of Hermite type functions, but we are going to adjust the Gaussian multiplier to the net function, you know, you skip with the orthogonal polynomials, with a decay rate that recognizes that there is a steady state. Okay? So it's not just the classical, as people like to call, the angle function of the Hamiltonian, the of lowest order as their mid function, or mid function, sorry. So what we have done is we developed the discontinuous Galerkin method, which actually it was I saw it first from Chi-Wan Shu, a good friend and collaborator of mine, and he made a beautiful presentation in which he proposed to use a sort of Ricci method on basis functions which are not necessarily polynomials. And he said this is the way, for instance, to compute the KdV equations. And they are actually still pursuing into that. And I said, well, maybe if that is the case, this could be a good tool to try into our base functions. You know, I also have to say that I take advantage that being in ISES, I have the fifth floor is populated by people that only do discontinuous Galerkin for all sorts of problems you can imagine. So we do have at hand a good expertise, and we can ask questions and get things answered quite quickly. And we said, well, why not try other polynomial bases? And Richard got very interested and started to do all these calculations, and results started to come up. And so Maria wrote the estimates, and we were very happy. And I think what we have is something nice. I don't know, if not spectacular, but somehow. So, okay, the domain that we take, so the simulations I'm going to show you at this level is a Cartesian grid on which we split a space, physical space, from phase space. You know, and we do it in two dimensions by saying it's one space and one velocity space. The extension to higher dimensions is doable. It's a very straightforward thing. There is a tons of, as I said, an army of people doing high dimension discontinuous Galerkin is certainly going to increase the computational complexity and work proportional to dimensions, but this is a fact of life, and we know that. Want to do higher dimensional calculations, it takes a lot of effort. So the way we do it is we assume the domain to be square, and we are going, as I said, once we decide our computational domain, we take it to be zero at the boundaries, the solution to be zero at the boundaries. And for the discontinuous Galerkin, let me just present it very quickly for you. It's essentially, for those that are familiar, it boils down, although it is formulated as a finite element method, it was originally, finite elements were originally introduced for elasticity theory, even for parabolic problems. They were not called discontinuous Galerkin. Discontinuous Galerkin were actually developed for transport theory. The first paper is by Reed and somebody else, I don't remember, it was to calculate the Boltzmann sort of relaxation equation. I will not call it Boltzmann, but it comes from early 80s, and essentially boils down that if you take a discontinuous Galerkin for a pure transport operator, right, it is, and you take a lower basis functions, then you get that this is essentially a finite difference scheme with upwinding. And the upwinding is exactly comes up into the way you are going to be defining what we call the upwind function, is how fluxes would transfer across adjacent boundaries. Okay? And so nowadays, for instance, they have designed what is discontinuous Galerkin for parabolic methods that would need an extra care of the diffusion part, and this is what they call the interior penalty methods, and Wheeler. There is again Wheeler, Dawson, even Arnold, Bretzi. I mean, it's a lot of people working on that, and there is the careful error estimates were written in 2000 by Wheeler, Dawson, Wheeler, Riviere, and Giro. Okay. So, okay, so what we use is then, I'll show you in a minute how we do it. So the Galerkin, in fact, Galerkin comes from a weak formulation. Galerkin doesn't mean anything in numerics. It's really much more about talking about the weak formulations of equations and representing them as reconstruction of basis functions. And in particular, when you do it in a discrete formulation, you carefully need to choose spaces which are going to have good properties. They have to be dense in the space in which you are building your simulation. And we have tried actually three different ones, which are polynomial bases, trigonometric bases, or a type of Hermite function bases, but where we adjust the bases. And so we try the three of them, and I will report on what we get. So I'm going to speed up a little bit. The implementation essentially is, because you talk about bases, it will be a sort of a basis angle function expansion in a finite dimensional formulation. And so what you reduce it is to discretize this operator transport apart in an explicit way. We would have a higher third order room to the discretization of time. And here we will put the bilinear form, which is given by the following formulation, in the sense that the test functions have to be exactly on the same approximating space, and this is exactly it, and this is what you have to solve in a discrete setting. I should say F here certainly depends on psi of H. So let me talk a little bit about what the basis functions are. And I actually might not have chosen a good notation. The basis here, you would see, you would have to have the test function, you would have to be this phi function, not psi. Okay. And so the weak formulation in the discrete setting becomes on this form, which gives you, as we know, a sort of recursion formula for the coefficients, which have to be solved in time, and you compute them in the basis functions, and then you reconstruct the solution by just multiplying. That would be really sort of angular function expansion, but for this particular basis reconstruction. And so we use a Runge third order method, Runge-Kutta. And yes.
We have with those jump operating conditions.
yes, right? We orthogonalize them. Yeah. Because you can actually, you know, this is a good thing about discontinuous. It doesn't matter if you have something discontinuous. We don't care about the solution being continuous or not. You may penalize it to be more continuous. But it's not
well, because they don't overlap.
Right. Yeah, it's just the important thing is how you do this upwind and flux. Okay? I have to say that we do not profit from the upwelling yet because we are not computed by a transport. It's confined. But eventually, if we know how to resolve the issues of the boundary conditions and so on, you may actually incorporate transport shocks in X, whatever, or sharp interfaces in a space. Okay? Although none of the simulations we have would present this at this point. But the code is ready somehow. Okay, so in that case, we have the weak formulation, as I mentioned, which in the discretized form takes this particular setting, where now psi and wh would be indeed functions in the approximating space. And the second differential operator gets to be approximated or written in this form. When we do the approximation of functions, we actually use the fact of how good the basis functions are to profit on how to do this in the optimal way. Okay? How to do the approximation of the pseudo differential operator in the optimal way. So we put boundary conditions. We take okay, this is the classical way to deal with the boundary conditions on VG. And what else? Yeah.
Pardon?
Well, okay, sorry. In fact, what I'm doing here, I'm sorry, I may might be swing an R to D. The framework, I said it would be to D, so I would have to, if I want to do it in R to D, I have to talk about the basis functions in R D, and then you take a Cartesian basis.
But it's just a Fourier transform in the previous integral, the inner bounds of the integral.
Let's see.
That one, involving delta V.
Yeah. Okay, let me show you. That's exactly what I'm. This is exactly what I'm going to discuss. Okay, because this is where we figure it out, and I say we, but I have to give credit to Richard that gave a lot of thought on how to do these integrations properly. Okay, and because I believe it's the cutest or the most interesting part of it. So all right, so here is where it comes. The approximation of the pseudo-differential operator. So if you use a test function in the bilinear form, you can actually write them using this Fourier representation. The test functions are going to be, and this is important, that you split in Cartesian form the space and phase space. And so what we do is we take advantage of how the potentials are going to be, because this particular form really depends on what the potential is and what the space you choose for, okay? Or you choose to approximate. And so let me give you the first example, which is because we will do what is called the particle in a box, and if you take a discontinuous potential. So in that case, you may immediately use the fact that the inverse Fourier transform is an exact formula, which is an oscillatory formula, so you just use that, okay? And you profit from that, okay? I mean, that might be a trick, but so be it, okay? That's what we do a lot of times with numerics. This is what we need to figure out how to do it. So in the case on which you take a potential which is an oscillatory form, by the way, I should say, when the potential is harmonic, you just are going to compute the classical. And when we look at the perturbations of harmonic potentials, we are going to use in the simulation that the harmonic potential, we do the classical term, replace it in the solver by putting the classical term. And so we say the perturbations are going to be this discontinuous potential, which, or, for instance, trigonometric perturbations. And that is a great tool because if you do the trigonometric perturbations, that what you can see is that you have a beautiful explicit representation of trigonometric functions for this particular inverse Fourier transform, and that gives you a localization, right, of operators acting on the solution. And there is what you have the integral. All right? And that, you know, you may say, well, what do you do if your potential is not in trigonometric? Function, I would tell you, well, it's just approximated by a Fourier function. Right? You can always do that. I mean, maybe there is a better solver, but this would do it this way. Okay, and so in particular, it says the optimal way of computing this bilinear form, it would be a discrete formulation where the basis functions is certainly separated in phase space and space. And I think this is the most important part. Okay? So you have to be careful if you implement DGs, you don't want to fuss about with these DG elements which are mixing directions, which may have very important applications to other type of problems. And so we get a discrete pseudo-differential operators for expansions of trigonometric potential perturbations in trigonometric form, let us say. Okay, the error estimates, this is something that Maria has put a lot of thought into it. And basically, we borrow the error estimates that were written by Grigier, Wheeler, and Giraud for parabolic operators, on which you obtain the classical interpolation estimates. And then, in both cases, the sort of rescaling estimates in the domain and the classical interpolation estimates, if you do it, for instance, in in H2, which you assume differentiability of the solution. By the way, at this point, I'm assuming regularity. I'm not discussing how good the solution is. And I'm really going into approximations. And so in particular, what we can obtain is when you combine the Riviere-Wheeler estimates with the Arnold, Damo, and Mancini, you can get actually very nice error estimates for the for the approximate pseudo-differential operator, independently of the form, because the way I this explicit form is to make it easier computationally, but you can still write the estimates. And in particular, we can prove the consistent stability of the scheme in the sense that the whole scheme is going to be stable for any given time, depending on the initial state, and you get this particular control. And also, what you get is an error estimate in L2 for any finite time capital T. And the estimates, as I said, combined the work of estimates from the Wigner equation combined with the fact that you have estimates for the parabolic solvers. They put them all together, and it's nothing else than a Grandval lemma. I should say that I believe, and I have not put much thought into that, but there is a way to, for certain, I mean, what I'm trying to say is this, the Vichy schemes somehow are probably among the most entropic schemes you can find, because they are naturally designed for problems of which you can multiply, for which you have what we call nowadays entropies, where you can find a functional for which you have a decay rate associated to the scheme, and that could be just an L2 functional, it could be F log F if you put a lower order type of thing, but they tend to be mass conservative, so you have the property of conservations would come very nicely, and they give, or even if you have to conserve energy or things like that, they would give you up to an error control of the mesh size. You can actually show that these are good good scheme to recover decay rates. So what do I have here? I have a lot of stuff. So if I said something, I don't know, you stop me, Richard. Okay, so then what we did here is the following. We started to check the validity of, we are benchmarking the code with the classical potential. So when I say the classical potential, there is nothing of the Wigner equation I'm computing here because I'm just doing the calculation with the classical transport. Nevertheless, I use it to calibrate property, the decay rate properties that I should see even if I'm close to these potentials, okay? And I'll show you that that is the case. So we calibrated, it's a very careful study on which we look at with number of elements, and this is, when you look at here, it should be n, the mesh size of the is n squared, so it's n on each direction. And by the way, the calculations are all done with uniform grids. There is no need why DG cannot be done with unstructured grids, actually in a space and time. We have not implemented yet, but it can be done, and that is not a big deal. So that might be another tool that could be very handy down the road. So if you do actually, we calculated the difference on one, then we look at the difference between the numerical solution versus the, I don't know if I have it in this table. It's the numerical solution. Oh, yeah, here it is. It's the numerical solution versus the stationary solution of the problem in the whole space. And so when we have to do this calculation and looking at this error, we have to be very careful because we have cut the domain. And this formula is valid in all space. Okay? And in fact, we did the calculation that the domain we are using is so large that the error we do in losing mass is like 10 to the minus 25, which is much below that any error that is due to the numerics. 10 to the minus 10, sorry. Between 10 to the minus 10 and 10 to the minus 25, little room for showing anything, but it's that. But we do fine. I mean, we are still doing very well in errors. And again, we did the calculation of the L1 error and the calculation of the L2 weighted norm, which is the one that we should be using, and in fact, it's the case nicer than with respect to that norm. Is that right or not? Not necessarily. In any case, we do it on the case, okay? The other, so the stationary state, when I say mu, is this function, as I say, it's valid in all space, and we look at the decay rate that comes from the Bakri-Emery inequalities, which in the particular case what we are computing for this part, or for the operator we use that has this stationary state, can be exactly computed with this rate. And we run several things. I show you some beautiful movies, and well, I don't know. And but this particular one is one where you expect the stationary state because it's actually the harmonic potential with an initial state which has one three terms, and which are two of them are connected in the same aligned in space, but not in velocity space. 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Okay. Then I'm speeding up because I want to show you the movie. So here what we see is in these three first lines is the error in we are looking here at the here is the numerical solution. Here I know this is the difference. Okay, so this is the difference of the numerical solution to the stationary solution mu. Okay, and what we see, it gets better as we increase the mesh points, as we decrease the mesh size, as it is expected. These lines are the lines of decay rate. So what we can see that while it decays, then it picks up numerical errors, so you don't want to see that. But while it decays faster, actually, than what is predicted by the upper bound of the Bakri-Emery inequality. So we at least decay as good as. These ones here are actually the difference between the computed solution and the computed stationary solution, which decays much faster, which in my view says that actually the code is really very stable and approaches a very nice stationary state. Yes?
Short question. What was the initial function that you used?
In this case, we...
With respect to the... Is this any eigenfunction of the...
No. We have not here.
Okay.
Nothing of that we reported here.
Okay.
And again, here we do an accuracy table. I have it in the slides, we have it in the paper, but essentially we test the polynomials, trigonometric function, and the mid function. And we said here that the mid function, we adjusted the width with taking the largest eigenvalue associated to the two-dimensional quadratic form coming in the stationary state. And actually, that is important because somehow this is what replaces the fact that we are using a stationary state associated not to the Hamiltonian of the Schrödinger equation, not to what the people call the stationary Schrödinger equation, but really rather using the knowledge of the stationary state. Okay? And in that case, you can do with a very few mesh points, four mesh points, you can put one Hermite function and you conserve mass. You get four basis functions and you still conserve mass. And actually, you do very little error in the weighted norm, in the L1 norm. And here, actually, you do pretty well if you consider that you are putting only four mesh points. It's a huge grid, okay? And the other ones actually do pretty well for mass. You tend to do much better with polynomials. In fact, BG is conservative on polynomials. They might lose a little bit. You have a little bit of error in mass when you use the trigonometric basis, but they seem to be very well when you put the correct mid adjustment for the decay. And then let me show you now a few movies. Oh. No? Where am I? There. Okay, so here is this initial state, as you saw the picture. In that case, it decays, and the decay rate we have checked it is as good as we had it before, and it goes at the same stationary state as if we put the Gaussian. But now, look what happens when we start to do, okay, here's another test which is important. We do now small perturbations, very small perturbations of harmonic potentials by putting a small oscillation. And we want to see if the code runs properly. And in fact, what we check is actually the decay rate of the computed solution, the stationary computed solution to the, let me, a couple of minutes to show you, to the computed stationary state mu was for the harmonic potential. And those numbers decay very nicely as A starts to be smaller, which means that I am actually doing very well as I'm perturbing, I'm exciting a little bit from the harmonic potential, and still the code runs very well as the errors are completely under control. Okay, I don't need to show you the movies. But here comes the very interesting thing. So now I'm going to show you a large bounded deviation from a harmonic potential, because here we have no conclusion. So this is the harmonic potential, and we have added this particular wave. This is great, because we have an explicit way to integrate this perturbation in the code. We have separated the harmonic part. Okay, and in that case, we start with an initial state, which is for positive x, zero, so it's a Gaussian, which has been shifted, but it's zero in phase space. And we call it triple well, because these are the significant wells. This is start, you know, it would never get to be here. It might get something here, and you see what you get to see. And you will see that these simulations, by the way, you see something coming up from here. We are not losing mass. The mesh is much, the domain is much larger than what I'm plotting, okay? There's a lot of, I'm just plotting something where it doesn't matter. So what you see is that most of the populated area came up here, then it comes up this part, and then we start to see that if we compute long enough, and I show you the next slide, look at level surfaces around for very, very small errors, we see that something could be forming up here. But we really do not know if there will be a way for which this state comes up to here, which is the lowest. Well, so that we don't know, and I'm not sure what we conclude from here. Let me show you another simulation. This is pretty much the same, and this went for much longer time. That's why it goes so fast. You cannot see it. It gets into here very quick, and then 90% of the time keeps on computing, and these things start to show up. Now, this is not even showing up here, okay? This is because we are doing the level surface for 10 to the minus 6, 10 to the minus 7. Is this a method stable state? We have to wait forever to see something. That's what we do not know. Let me show you another one. Okay, this is where you see the evolution with the level surface and the rotations, and the same thing here. And these are the plots. And in fact, this is this one, which is the highest populated, which you saw the big one, corresponds to this one. No, it's not the lowest energy level. So we don't know what it would take up here. I don't know if it is the code. I don't know if it is something funny here. The perturbation potential is very large. That's what I'm saying. Now, and the other interesting thing is you see here, you start to see the formation of more wells. So this one is this, one, two is this, one, three and four, you don't see, they should be here and here, would correspond to this one and that one. But this only shows up after 50,000 time steps, okay? Only if you go and look at the errors, 10 to the minus 9, 10 to the minus 6. Right? So if it is important to resolve it or not, that's up to the physicists. What I'm not sure, I don't understand why is it that maybe I don't know enough physics to answer, it stays here and not there. And then the last two, yes. The last two, these are cute. These are symmetric initial states, but look what happens. Okay. One is wider than the other. And again, we see this metastable state, they go very fast and they stabilize in something that's different. So is it, this is a linear problem. If all of a sudden, look at this stationary state we observe, depend on the initial state, and I do not see exactly where the variation is going to come. Maybe I have to wait forever. This is exactly my conclusion. We need to study the eigenvalues of the system. Okay, the particle in a box, I jump it, but this is, I'm going to thank the audience before I finish, but so things that may be important is to look for better bases, Fanion functions, and to study the numerical eigenvalues and see what is, what you can infer in terms of the existence of the standard state of mind. But I don't have an answer for that. Thank you very much.